You're listening to the Leaping Cholla podcast, recorded in the Wrong Mountain Yurt in the Sonoran Desert.
I am falling away from this world. I am falling away from this world. You are calling me back to you.
Okay, we're going. We're in section 11, subsection 11, right?
Yes.
Of section 110, is that right? Page 165. And is it 110?
Yeah.
And Contributions to Philosophy of the Event by Martin Heidegger. So, subsection 11, away we go.
Okay. 11. The foremost subsequent and more appropriate version of Platonism, the theory of ideas as theory of the beingness of beings, is not idealism, but realism. Res, the what, the thing, realitas, as whatness, essentia, the genuine medieval realism, the universal, constitutes the en qua en.
Yeah, I think that's going to be race and ens qua ens. Yeah. Yeah, that's a really sweet little paragraph. I mean, what a cool distinction that the most appropriate version of Platonism, which is the theory of ideas as the theory of the being of beings, the beingness of beings, is not idealism, but realism. Then he kind of breaks that down for us. Race just means thing in Latin, the what, the thing. Realitas as whatness, essentia, reality as essence or essential. The genuine, which is the genuine medieval realism. Essence was seen as the real in medieval times, and the universale constitutes the ends qua ends, the end as end, the goal as ultimate goal, the universal. So, you know, I think that's an interesting take on what we mean by realism, what people mean when they say they're being realistic.
Yeah, I don't get it. Can you explain?
Yeah, so, I mean, if you think about, as he says here, Platonism is the theory of ideas as theory of the beingness of beings. So, Platonism, again, is an understanding of the world as a reflection of forms. That's classical Platonism. Heidegger's expanded on that to say that the we now have a world in which, you know, this post-Platonist or subsequent Platonism, in which we view the world as being a kind of reflection of being or beingness, and beings are a reflection of beingness. So beingness becomes the form or the idea, and being is beings is the world. So you have that same kind of.
I just want to clarify. I get that part. I just don't get the difference between realism and idealism.
Yeah, I'm okay. I'm like three words away from that.
Awesome.
So when you talk about idealism versus realism, idealism would be it's kind of the predominance of ideas or ideals or forms. I think idealism, and probably in a philosophical sense, is that, you know, rooted in Platonism, that the the world is a reflection or a fractal or a projection of ideas, right? Mm-hmm. And we say what he says, but it's the real Platonism we're talking about is not idealism, but realism. So let's think. Then he goes on to talk about what he means by realism. So the real has its its etymological root in race or the thing. So realism is, in a sense, the philosophical faith or the ideological diktat of the idea of the real thing. And realists or realism kind of prides itself on engaging with and positing the the certainty or the necessity or the verifiability of things, and realism deals in those things. So reality becomes a whatness or as he calls it here, an essentia. So reality becomes essential. The world of things becomes the essence. And that's what genuine medieval realism was. The universal or the general or the formic is the end of all things. It's the cause of things, and it's that to which all things are moving. So what he's really trying to say is that in the claim of being a realist, there is this assumption that you're not an idealist, that you accept things as they truly are, as they really are, not as they ought to be, or as they are in the abstract, or in the ideal, or in the idea of them. What Heidegger is saying is that realism is actually just another form of idealism, or Platonism, or form-led thought, because the what, or the thing, and the realitas, the essential realitas, the universal, which reality becomes, is just another idea. It's just another form. It's just another way of constructing a kind of general law-giving, reality-giving, being-given-giving world, metaphysic, that you hold to be absolute and you hold to be the ends qua ends. So he's really kind of saying that Platonism takes many forms throughout history. Mm-hmm. And in today's world, the realists are the new Platonists because they hold the real as sort of transcendentally removed from bang, I would say, as people used to hold the forms or the ideas. The real has just become the new form, the new essence, the new universal. Yeah?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay, great.
That's cool.
Well, I wormed my way out.
Seems accurate.
I squirmed out of that one, didn't I? In the middle there, you might have felt it. I was feeling a little bit like in trouble.
Oh, really? I didn't sense that.
You know, I'm not allowed to pause for too long because then it's clear that I'm like lost. So I have to keep talking. Go ahead.
12. Through nominalism, however, the factuality of the individual becomes the genuine realitas, and realitas is accordingly claimed for the distinguishing characteristic of the individual. For what is immediately present at hand here and now for existentia. Remarkable, the term reality now comes to mean existence, actuality, there-ness.
Yeah, I would say keep reading, because I think he's going to continue on this thought.
13. For various motives, the individual soul, the individual human, the I, is experienced correspondingly as what most eminently is, as the most real being, and only in that way is the ego cogito ergo sum possible at all. In this assertion, being is attributed to the individum.
Individuum. Individuum.
Whereby it is to be noted that the assertion properly refers to the certainty of the mathematical relation between cogitare and esse, the axiom of methesis.
Yeah. So he uses this word nominalism. What is nominalism? Nominalism is the philosophical view that general concepts or universals are not real entities, but are simply names or labels we use to group similar individual objects. It asserts that only particular things exist, and abstract concepts like triangularity or redness are human constructs, not independently existing objects. Two main types of nominalism are nominalism about universals, which denies properties exist, and nominalism about abstract objects, which denies the existence of entities that do not exist in space and time, such as numbers or propositions. So nominalism essentially says that these things that we've called categories, names, universals, abstract objects, numbers, propositions, forms, ideas, these things are just names. That's where you get not the word nominal, is etymological to name. So it's just kind of a linguistic reduction of abstract thought. So Heidegger, through nominalism, the this, meaning the factuality of the individual, becomes the genuine realitas. So because nominalism rejects the kind of essentia and universale and ideal that Platonism posits as the world of forms, what is real, what is reality, is the thisness of the individual. So there's a kind of a sense of the individual as an object separate from all those silly abstractions, right? And realitas, or reality, is accordingly claimed for the distinguishing characteristic of the individual. So the individual alone becomes reality, for what is immediately present at hand here and now, for existentia. And I think it's important to realize that, you know, he's talking, when we hear the word individual, we think individual person, but I think he's actually just talking about individual entities in the world. And the term reality now comes to mean existence, actuality, and there-ness. So reality becomes a thing filled with individual objects that exist, that are present at hand, and that are in a sense unquestionable. And for various motives, so for various reasons that are reasons we give to ourselves in order to feel we have a reason, the individual, the individual soul, the individual human, the I, all those things are experienced correspondingly as what most eminently is. So out of that sort of a clutch of this is inside reality and given reality, the individual, the individual soul, the individual human, the I, these become the things that really are, that are the most real beings. And that's how the I think, therefore I am, is made possible. Because in this assertion, being, meaning the sum of ergo sum, sum means I am, is attributed to the individuum. So the I is is seen as existing, whereby it is to be noted that the assertion that I think, therefore I am, properly refers to the certainty of the mathematical relation between to think and to be, the axiom of mathesis. So there is a mathematical relationship, an equation of equality, an identity, basically, between the I and the am via thought. And so, again, he's kind of pointing out that all of this is these are the characters in the drama of what we call reality. But they are held, all of these things, the individual human, the individual soul, the I, the thinking, the being, they're held with the same certainty and ends qua ends and essentiality as Plato held the forms. So we think that we've left behind this kind of mythological ancient world where they had this idea of, like, you know, forms and universals existing in the world somewhere, like gods, you know. But we haven't, because we still hold on to this coterie of certainties, almost with a mathematical allegiance inherent in the idea of things like I think, therefore I am. Mm-hmm. Okay.
14. Now no longer does idea signify the universale as such in the Greek sense of the look of presencing. It refers instead to the perceptum grasped in the percipere of the ego. It means perceptio in the ambiguity of our word representation. If idea is taken so broadly, then even what is individual and changeable is a perceptum. The idea as perceptum, the idea in its shining back, the idea as look, the idea in the shining forth of presencing. It is only the interpretation of idea as perceptio that turns Platonism into an idealism. The beingness of beings now becomes representedness, and beings are thought of idealistically. You want to read this?
Esse is verum esse, is certum esse, is ego percipio, cogito me cogitare. So to be is to be true, is to be certain. I think to think myself.
Consequently, in Kant, the ideas are indeed saved, but only as representations and principles of reason qua human reason. From here, the step to absolute idealism, Hegel's concept of ideas, cf. The following excerpt.
Excursus, following section in which I explain all this, yeah.
The absolute self-appearance to itself of the absolute as absolute knowledge, thereby possible to grasp Plato in a new way and assign Greek philosophy to the phase of immediacy.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay.
Then we move on to an excursus on Hegel. So, yeah, so we have these two words, idea and eidos. They are again a little interchangeable. They mean look, they mean essence, they mean form, they mean idea. I would say eidos is probably a little more leaning toward what we would think of as ideal or essence or form. And idea is probably leaning a little more towards what we think of as the look of something or the idea of something. But again, the lines are blurry here. But what he's talking about here now is that as we've stepped into the contemporary era, Platonism has transformed and such that the form or the idea isn't a universal or a general abstract, like the Greeks thought of the essence of presencing, like the Greeks thought of absolute form of presence. It refers instead to the perceptum grasped in the percipere of the ego. So the idea or the form is now actually the what is perceived in the eyes perceiving. It means perceptio. So the idea is perception. So we have that definition of these words as look, the look of something. But it's morphed a little bit now into the form or the idea of things is now thought of as perception, which is linked here. So he says ambiguously to the word representation, representation, perception, projection, visual immanence, seeing, these kind of things. If idea is taken broadly, so if perception and representation are taken broadly, then even what is individual and changeable is a perceptum. So even what is, he's used this dyad of words, individual and changeable, even in a sense, bang, or the momentary eventful being, is a perceptum. So it's a thing that is perceived. In other words, what there is, beings, individual and changeable, are kind of conceptually swept up into what we mean by a perceptum and the way we use and cognize and metaphysicize within the influence and of perceptum as a core concept. The idea as eidos, so the idea as essence, the idea in the shining forth of presencing. The idea becomes the shining forth of presencing. It is only the interpretation of idea as perceptio, as perception, that turns Platonism into an idealism. The beingness of beings now becomes representedness. So through the idea becoming a perceptio and the link that he's made between perceptio and representation, the beingness of beings, so the essence of beings, what is being, becomes representedness. So now being has been lifted up into representation, and beings are thought of idealistically through the ideal of perceptio, through the idea of them. And to be means to come to be true, to be certain. The I perceives, the I thinks. The I thinks itself, perceives itself. And these ideas are preserved in Kant, he says. From here, the step to absolute idealism, which is Hegel. The self-appearance to itself of the absolute as absolute knowledge becomes possible. So this march of Platonism through time has transformed into the idea of the absolute self, the self appearing to itself absolutely and establishing absolute presence and truth. Yeah, which is, I would say to contextualize this quickly, this is an excursus, to use his word, on the development of conceptual habitus through thousands of years up till now that has left us in a place where representation, perception, realism, reality, thingness, certainty, truth, these kind of things that these words he's been using to define what we're kind of calling the liberal metaphysic, how they came to be, how these things came to be, how they are foundationalized by some of these conceptual assumptions about, well, not even about, these conceptual assumptions that are underlaid by the transition from Platonism of the Greeks and of Plato to the Platonism of now, where realism, perception, representation, certainty, you know, a faith in the beingness of beings, an avoidance of the question of being, has come to be the new absolute, the new religion, the new metaphysic, the new machination, the new worldview, the new certainty, the new truth, what we're calling, in a sense, the liberal order.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. Well said.
So, I don't know. Any thoughts on that section so far?
Not particularly.
Yeah, I mean,
the next section looks cool, but
do we really want to dive heavy into Hegel here? I mean, maybe we should save that for next time.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Should we talk about something?
Sure. Do you have
in
any
in the real world? I don't know. Do you? I don't know. What?
I don't actually.
You don't have any no
really.
Tidbits to feed me.
Yeah.
No concerns, no news. I mean, I suppose we can talk about, you know.
Do we have anything to say about it? Do we have anything to say about it?
I mean,
the word representation is interesting in that context.
Oh, go ahead. What? Tell me about. I think we're talking about the communist mayor of New York. Is that what we're talking about?
Yes.
Okay, great.
Yes.
The liberal apotheosis of our time. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, just seeing Heidegger use the word representation, it made me think of how it's currently used as a, like, I guess as like a rallying cry, and that it's important that everything is represented. All people, all ideas. I mean, I don't know if that's, or at least there's a lip service to that, whether or not it's actually the case.
Yeah, I mean, I think representation, you know, I think it has multiple meanings, obviously. I mean, representation has a long history as a word in politics, you know, in the sense of, you know, that you know, politicians represent people. You're looking for representation. If you're going to be taxed, you want to be represented. We have representatives, blah, blah, blah. But I think, and now we have represent, the idea of representing and represent, meaning, you know, there are, you know, the race communists feel that, you know, certain races are not represented because of their race, because in a sense, I would say to a race communist, one race cannot represent another race. So it's kind of impossible to a race communist for a white person to represent a black person or vice versa, or, you know, it's anybody of any different color, unless, you know, there's kind of this mushy rainbow coalition thing where, like, if you're a part of the rainbow coalition, you can represent each other, but it requires a sort of membership in the rainbow coalition. And that membership has a lot of sort of rites and rituals and self-flagellations that get you membership. Like, you really got to pay your dues to get that membership. And then you can kind of, you know, people of so-called one hue can represent people of another hue. But if you're not in the Rainbow Coalition, then your race really is a problem, you know, and in the clarity and ethicality of representation. But yeah, representation is a thick and thorny word now. I mean, I'm kind of reminded of, like, you know, like in Mamdani's speech, you know, he talks about, you know, New York is built by, and then he goes on to list like 9 ethnicities, you know, an ethnicity name with like a menial job name, you know, it's really like, it's really religious crap. You know, the Ethiopian whatevers and the Venezuelan whatevers and the
taxi drivers.
Yeah, and on and on. You know, it's just tripe for pigs. But identitarian tripe, I'm sorry. That's why I'm calling it tripe, because it is identitarianism. But it is representation, and the people are cheering because he's saying these ethnic phrases and thereby giving representation to these people who ostensibly have not been represented, for nobody can really say why, other than that the system apparently has a certain chronic case of representational constipation that doesn't get people moving through the asshole of the system in the way that the assholes wish. So, you know, being representing has become this kind of fetish. I mean, and Mamdani is a fetishist and an identity fetishist. When he talks about identity, you can literally see him drooling. Yeah. You can literally imagine his like penile glands expanding as he talks about different races and identities. And of course, at the root of everything that he talks about is a rabid, disgusting hatred for people who have more money than he deems necessary. You know, he's a real monster.
Yeah,
I could go on and on. And I guess I could feed me a little something. No, seriously, throw me a little bit of fake and bacon, and I can keep talking.
I mean, I don't know. I don't. I mean, I think it's great he got elected. It's the democratic process.
I too love the democratic process. I also think it's great he got elected. I mean, I think it's great. I agree with the process that elected him. I always at every election I revel in the democratic process and I say yay. Yeah. There's been a democratic process. Somebody has been elected and now we get to live with it.
And I just think it's going to be interesting to see. I mean, I think the problem is we don't know if anything that we hear from it is true, you know. But in theory, it seems like it'll be interesting to see how it goes. I think.
Let me say quickly. I mean, I agree with that because I personally find the whole like he's a communist thing to be pretty boring, because the fact is like if communism works, then up with communism.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't really care. Like he's technically a democratic socialist. I mean, he's a communist, but none of that is of concern to me because communism is a proposition that might actually work. So whatever, there are parts of Mamdani that will never work and do not work and are abhorrent. It's not his communism that is abhorrent. I mean, I don't like communism, but the idea of trying communism is kind of fascinating, because if you want to try it, give it a try.
Yeah.
There are other things about him that nobody should be trying, but go ahead.
Yeah, I think I found it interesting that, I mean, like, just the exit polls, who was voting for him, and one thing, like, one graph I saw recently, which I don't know is true, but just the idea that basically the longer someone has been in New York City, the less likely they were to vote for him. And obviously native-born New Yorkers were the least likely to vote, whereas those who had been there under 5 years were the most likely to vote for him. So it's an interesting, I mean, New York is just such an interesting case study of people coming from other places and going there and then claiming it as their home. And there hasn't been much. I mean, we lived there for 15 years. I lived there 15 years. You lived there for 30 years or something, right?
32, baby.
32. There's really not a lot. like, it, like, I don't know. I feel like the places we were anyways is like people just kind of accepted that, yes, there are people there with a lot. There are people there who have lived there forever, and there are people like us who just were there for some amount of time, often as artists or money makers or whatever. So it's just... but then the other factor of that is it's kind of interesting that basically people who aren't born there get to choose the fate of the city or the future of the city, when, you know, they could easily, they have more flexibility to leave. But I'm not really saying anything very interesting. But I did find that statistic to be interesting.
It is an interesting statistic, I suppose. I mean, you know, New York is always being refreshed with new people, and there's always a lot of new people. I mean, some people are like, oh, there's been this influx of illegal immigrants or whatever. Well, you know, that's what happens in New York, you know, and whatever with that. You know, there's always been this tension in New York between, like, you know, oh, the old New York was so much better, man, and all these new buildings and all these new kids, yeah, and all this new bullshit and all this, you know, which, you know, I've always been like, man, New York is about turnover. It's about turnover. It's about new buildings. It's about new meat, new dreams, new methods. It's what it is. It's why it's the capital of capitalism. But, you know, I think that a lot of people on the right are seeing it and saying, you know, this is a case study. This is proof of our theory that this mass immigration that was carried out, right, in the last bunch of years was simply being done under the shadow or the cloak of just like, America is a nation of immigrants and diversity is our strength, blah, blah, blah. But really it's just bolstering the Democratic voting pool, which is of course, obviously true. You know, and I wish Democrats would just admit that, because it would be like refreshing for them to be like, oh yeah, we're just playing power games. that would just be really refreshing, but they won't, of course. Yeah. But you know, and that's the way it goes. I mean, to me, I obviously have a very personal kind of journey with all of this. You know, I mean, the people who voted for Mamdani are the same people who kind of drove me out of New York, the same people who ruined my life in New York, the same people who, in my view, ruined New York. Again, the race communists, the racialist artists, the identity political identitarian political class, the awful racists
who made it so in theater you had to play the race you are,
they're just identitarian and authoritarians. They're terrible people. They've destroyed the arts, just really, I think of them as suicide bombers. Like, they snuck into all the arts institutions and then blew themselves up, and blew everybody up with them. Or actually, they blew everybody else up.
They're the opposite of suicide bombers.
I don't know what they are, but ideally, hopefully, they are suicide bombers, because I don't think inevitably it will work. But you know, one thing I was thinking today is like, and I kind of lived this. There used to be this kind of healthy relationship between artists and the wealthy.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about, like, you know, 100 years ago.
Patronage,
you know.
That's a very long historical relationship.
Yeah. And, you know, starting in the 60s, you know, the man and the rich became crap. And art became a war against the rich, and artists became de facto, you know, proletariat revolutionaries who were looking to tear down the rich. And they've, you know, through the accident of geography and demographics, New York has had this interesting parallel development over the last 60 years of finance bros, right, and artists, and both of those populations have grown and grown and grown in New York, And those populations are ever more increasingly at odds. Mm. Because the artists used to praise the wealthy and the wealthy paid them for their praise. But now the artists hate and criticize the wealthy. And frankly, I think that the wealthy are abandoning the arts. Mm-hmm. I experienced that living there. You know, I was a young radical liberal revolutionary and I hated the rich and I badmouthed them in my plays and they slowly abandoned me. and it was one of the great mistakes of my life. And it was one of the hatreds that, you know, 15 years ago, I started to sense and smell in myself and in other New Yorkers. It was kind of the core hatred that I smelled in liberalism that I had previously held as being the antidote to hate. But liberalism is now just rabid, aggressive, gross hatred for the rich. It's bad news. So what you have, and I saw this happening at New Dramatists, you know, the arts in New York City are funded by grant-making organizations and wealthy individuals. My sense is that that money is drying up. And that it's becoming...
At least the wealthy individuals, not the grant
organizations. Well, yeah, I mean, the wealthy individuals are behind the grant-making organizations. You know, I'm not saying it's drying up. It's not gone by any sense. But I think that you're seeing a ever-widening gulf between the rich of New York and the what are really kind of like the art working class. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's harder and harder to make money in the arts. And so I think that artists are feeling more and more pinched in New York because, I mean, the rents are going up and artists are pinched, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, you also have... The second thing which is happening, which is that I think New York City as the center of arts, the center of the arts, has half its body in the grave.
Yeah, I hope so.
Well, we both hope so, yeah, but deeply. But I think that the internet will eventually fully kill New York as an art center.
Yeah, I mean, the art there, it's just all political. So I don't know if...
Well, and the reason it's political is because... Well, it's political for various reasons, but one reason it's political is the artists have needed to find a reason or a modus operandi that tries to justify their existence and say... I mean, by political art, what we mean is art is important or the people who make art are important. And that art is inherently important. You hear that all the time. Oh, it's sacred. It's community building. It just makes me vomit. The art in New York is more and more increasingly isolated as a funded, grant-enabled fetish and a kind of way of life. Mm-hmm. While around it, you have this ever-expanding, what's really a true competitive free market world of art, which is the internet, you know,
yeah,
where people are not funded. They're just trying to make content that they can get seen.
Yeah.
The artists in New York have stopped trying to get seen, and they've just become political mouthpieces, yeah, feeding yeah their local audience the kind of revolutionary crap that they want to see. That's why I talked about how I've been noticing this weird thing where I've been seeing these videos on my phone of like actual performances in New York City. And one after the other, it's standing ovation, standing ovation, standing ovation. These people standing in the audience, clapping at the end of a show, the artists are taking their bows on stage and everybody's standing. And, you know, it's like grade inflation, you know. What you have is the audiences are there to see a certain political point. The performers make that political point, and for their performance, they are applauded. They get a standing O. Mm-hmm. So what am I saying? It's just a total degradation of the real purity and anarchy that art is, in my view, supposed to be.
Yeah.
And I think that funnels into, now you have the creative class in New York, and they are being squeezed big time. And so they're fighting to keep New York. Mm-hmm. So they're fighting the rising prices, which are really hard to meet as an artist, as we know, the rising costs of living, which are really hard to meet, as we know. Because the balance between the cost of living in New York and what the grant-based money machine is feeding them is growing ever more out of scale, out of proportion. It's not working.
Yeah, well, it hasn't worked, I think, for quite a while.
Let's hope not. I mean, and let's hope the artists are all sort of eventually, you know, pushed out.
Right. Yeah.
Well, because they're going to try to kind of turn New York into an art commune.
Right.
Which, you know, in a sense, maybe that'll work. But the problem with an art commune is somebody's got to pay for everything in it.
Yeah.
And if the mantra of the art commune is anybody who could ever pay for us is evil, then the payments aren't going to be made. Mm-hmm. So there's like a phrase for this. They're shooting their face off to spite their foot, or whatever the phrase is. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They're biting their nose off to spite their face.
Yeah.
It's just because these liberal revolutionary do-nothings have taken over. There's like a good million of them. And now in the Unholy Alliance, they've gone and allied themselves with this ethnic fetishism, which makes perfect sense because they're all race communists and identitarian zealots who don't have any idea of working systems. All they have is an idea of identitarian alliances that feel really righteous, because they're literally just they're basically emanations of the ambition for class warfare.
Yeah. The
arts have become a war footing, a forward war march against the system, against the wealthy, against the normies, against the whites, against the men, against the women, against the establishment, whatever they want to say, you know, against the traitors, against the non-allies, against the reds, against whoever it is. Mm-hmm. It's a war footing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Mamdani is just kind of a pretty, smiley, screamy war boy. Mm-hmm. Who just wants to talk about war. Mm-hmm. Ethnic war. It's really ethnic war. Well, yeah. It's ethnic class war.
Yeah.
It's just war. Because apparently, again, people who don't talk, think, act, and spend the way that they believe they should are evil.
Yeah. So then, okay. So I looked at the map of it, and I get what you're saying about the creative class. I think that's very true. But also, like, we lived right next to Park Slope. Park Slope, Gowanus, is not the creative class, at least not Park Slope. And it was, like, fully voting for Mamdani as well. So I think there's also... I haven't quite understood why there are also people who are probably working as lawyers or some sort of high level something, and then they are really excited about this.
Well, like, but they're just zombies in the community, diversity, yeah. Anti-Trump. We need to just destroy everything, and we need to make sure liberalism is everywhere.
Yeah.
And the creative class is so important, and they consider themselves the creative class. I mean,
if you live in New York, you probably
they do. Know creators. They're creative. They create things. They're create, yeah. You know, and but also, you know, they they're I mean, they're just very palpably also just standing up for the mass immigration that that is bloating their voter rolls. You know, I mean, they're just very directly saying that Trump and his attack on, you know, illegal immigrants is offensive to us because we don't like losing power. I mean, they want all those illegal immigrants, and so they're standing up for those illegal immigrants. They're standing up for the cheaters and the tricksters and the sneakers because those people give them power, and it's their main obviously their power is not in ideas. They're pimping communism. Their power is in the destitute, the cheating, the newcomers who didn't play by the rules, who they have...
The stories of them.
Yeah, the stories of these people who they have romanticized into heroes, working class heroes, but really they're just using them to gain power. And they don't have the humanity or the morality to say, actually... A good number of those people cheated the system, and they're technically illegal immigrants. Now, there are also, by the way, very much legal immigrants in New York, and bless them, and it's wonderful they made it in, and I think it's great they are using the system. They're playing the system in the right way, and I met many so-called immigrants in New York City who I loved, and I was grateful for them. But that's not the game they're playing.
Yeah,
that is not the game they're playing. I also just think it's really slimy and dishonest to play this kind of, which Mamdani does, that like the Ethiopians and the Venezuelans and the Mexicans and the blah, 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 you know, these ethnic cliques, that they're being ruinated and discriminated against, and that the people who are not liberal zombies hate them, and that is absolutely not true. It's just an absolute class warfare lie.
Totally.
The right is very.
If you're in New York, you don't. It's like you would know that. That's like there's nothing there.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, then there's nothing there from so-called MAGA. MAGA doesn't want illegal immigrants. They want immigrants to do it the right way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, I will say, and I think this is important to talk about, you know, there is the anti-Muslim sentiment on the right.
Yeah.
And I oppose that sentiment. That is identitarianism. It's not acceptable. It's not acceptable to be anti-people because of their religion or their ethnicity. In any way. And I think Mamdani's Muslimness is completely irrelevant. He can be whatever religion he wants. I don't give a rat's ass. But I think we are also in the middle of this kind of Jew-Arab civil war, you know, civil war, whatever the kind of war it is, you know. And so people are taking sides on that. Which I'm not interested in doing.
Yeah.
Because I think that the whole, which, you know, well, here's what I would say. I think that the whole Palestinian-Israel thing is actually, and it never should be, an ethnic question. It's not about Muslim and Jews. It's a question of national sovereignty. It's a question of borders, international law, national law. It has nothing to do with ethnicity. And it should never be discussed in terms of ethnicity.
Oh, that's an interesting point.
I mean, it doesn't matter what the ethnicity of the people in Israel or Gaza are. That's completely irrelevant. What you're dealing with is a geographical, geopolitical state of affairs that should be thought about via the same principles that will apply anywhere, regardless of the ethnicity of the people. So anyhow, but I feel like I'm getting just like kind of really political, like way too political. I mean, I think so if we could bring it back to Heidegger and kind of what we read. You brought up representation, which I think was a really good point. It certainly got me talking. opened the floodgates. I don't know. I mean,
I always find how Heidegger is sort of remapping, or I don't know, remapping his, like, really the way that he maps these things that in my mind I've collapsed or I've taken for granted. And then just kind of finding those, like, extra stop, those extra points and everything just helps me, like, see in these situations, like this political situation, this, I don't know,
yes,
this New York situation, like a new perspective that I feel like without it, it's just really hard to get outside of what we see in the news, right, or what we, right, are trained to
out,
see.
Out of, it's hard to escape the newspaper science of it all, yeah, right? Yeah, that's right.
So anyway, so yeah, maybe there's something
well,
there.
I think that's right. And I think from the readings that we've seen here, what we can take away from this is what you might think of as the underpinnings of identitarian politics. Mm-hmm. That when a Mamdani and all of his brain dead followers use ethnicity and class, by class I mean sort of wealth variable, when they use these concepts, these identities, they are doing so under the pretense of being realists, under the pretense of talking about essences, aka identities, under the pretense of using representation as a reality to be considered. And even there's this word perceptio, look. Ethnicity is about how people look. And to Mamdani, certain people have the right look and certain people have the wrong look. And it's, you know, you could, and you know what, you could say that, okay, you could, from the left, they say Trump has the same thing. Trump does the same thing. Let's think about that for a second. Trump discriminates between legal and illegal immigrants. That is not actually an identitarian assessment. That is a division based on legal categories. It's not even a value judgment. It's a statement of legal fact. Mm-hmm. Mamdani, on the other hand, is not stating any legal facts. He's simply making value judgments and saying the rich are evil. These ethnicities are heroic and these ethnicities are oppressive. None of that is based on fact. That's all just ethnical conceptual masturbation. Mm-hmm. That's all just identitarian valuation. The very thing that people accuse Trump of, which he doesn't do, is what they're doing, which is identitarian valuation based on no legal fact. It's just based on an opinion, which is that these ethnicities and these classes of wealth are evil. That's it. Mm-hmm. So this vehemence that they have for Trump's supposed identitarianism is a lie and a smokescreen, because Trump is not actually an identitarian. Trump, you could probably say, is just a legal fact finder and takes the law seriously. He says, well, if we're going to have a law, if entering the country is going to have to do with law, then we're going to distinguish between legal and illegal. And so we're going to act on that. That's it. Mm-hmm. Nothing identitarian about that. Mamdani and the liberals are the identitarians. And that identitarianism is about perceptio. Mm. How, and so the look of people, their look, their essence, their form becomes real. And so when they talk about ethnicities and classes, which are simply groundless, contingent valuations of going beyond beingness, right? Mm-hmm. They're participating in a fantasy, mm-hmm. which is what Heidegger's kind of trying to say here. Mm-hmm. You know, they're just using representation. They're claiming representations as reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that is a fool's game, and that is delusion. And that is, I think, what Heidegger's kind of saying here, contemporary Platonism, right? Mm-hmm. And if you link original Platonism through the last 2,500 years, what Heidegger's really saying is it's really a series of delusions mm-hmm. and lies and fabrications and machinations. It has nothing to do with B-E-Y-N-G. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's what's maddening to me and to others about Mamdani mm-hmm. and many of his supporters and everything mm-hmm. is that mm-hmm. they are hiding behind this idea that their representations are real, but really their representations are just value judgments mm-hmm. that are baseless mm-hmm. and prejudiced and biased mm-hmm. destructive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we
divisive, abusive, and
yeah. Like if Mamdani's point was, it's against the law to have more than $100 million in value, but yet there are all these people who have $100 million in value, and so I'm going to go after those people who are breaking the law because they have more than $100 million in value, then I would say he's not an identitarian. Mm-hmm. But that's not what he's doing. Mm-hmm. If there was a law against being an Ethiopian tax driver or a Venezuelan maid or a Dominican nanny, if there was a law against a certain ethnicity and he was coming out and saying, I'm going to liberate these ethnicities from the absolutely illegalization of their existence, then I would say he's not an identitarian. Mm-hmm. He's standing up for the law, but that's not what he's doing. Mm-hmm. He's playing ethnic war. Mm-hmm. He's playing class war. Mm-hmm. That's what's revolting about what he's doing. Mm-hmm. And it's very par for the course for liberals because, and people have made this point over and over again, when liberals can't change the law to suit their objectives, they just start lying. Mm. What liberals need to do is they need to put forth the proposition mm-hmm. that it should be illegal to have over X dollars. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
And then it's not about hating the rich. It's just about saying, well, the rich are breaking the law, so we're going to go get them.
Yeah. Yeah.
But instead, they just want to play class warfare, which is really just theater. It's really just game playing, it's really just posing, it's really just representing.
Yeah.
And it's really just embarrassing and stupid.
Yeah.
Because it's not fact-based, it's not realism. They're not being realistic.
It is realism. They say it's realism, it's, yeah, but it's the idealist form.
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw something that said that, and I don't know. It said something like Trump's like has one of the most, you know, racially inclusive programs. I don't know, what do you call it? Like platforms or something, that he's done a really great job. And didn't he have a lot of racial diversity in his votes or something? Like a lot of different people were voting for him or have voted for him more than like they had other Republicans.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, we saw with Trump an increase in certain, black, Latino votes, whatever. Yeah.
But like some people are really proud of that. Like, I think, yeah. Like, conservatives, I think some conservatives are really proud of that, and they're very,
Yeah, well, they're sick of the stigma that conservatism is just a white thing. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
And they're hungry. They're hungry for people of other, you know, groups to come on board.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody is.
Yeah.
But yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure I have much more to say about it. I mean,
yeah. I just found that interesting because, like, obviously I'm newer to paying attention to conservative politics, but, like, I had never quite realized that that was, like, something they were really proud of, you know, that they actually, that they really almost run and relish, because the assumption, if you believe in the liberal media, is that they don't, and, you know, obviously. Yeah.
If you believe in the liberal media, wow, yeah, of course, yeah. Yeah.
So, like, even I, who like to think of myself as very open-minded, still had that in my mind, you know?
Yeah.
But then I think I'm realizing that that's not actually the case.
Yeah.
It's just about how they talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm losing my voice.
That's okay. You're losing your voice. All right. We're done for the night. We have a bit of a cold in the house, don't we? Yeah. All right. Thank you, everyone. Thank you. Good night, right? Good night.
Thanks for joining us for the Leaping Choya podcast. For more information, visit leapingchoya.com and be sure and follow us on socials. Until next time.